Now, the reason we're spending time talking about the Islamic State is because they have become the most effective Islamic terrorist organization in human history. They are not only able to find enormous sources of wealth, primarily through kidnap, through bank robberies, and through confiscating oil refinery sites and then selling the oil. But they're able to pull it off with considerable business acumen. Even in the selling of oil, vast amounts of it. But they're also the best armed Islamic terrorist organization in history. Not only receiving American arms to go fight Assad in Iraq and American arms to, as part of the awakening program, in Iraq and the other in Syria, but they also have confiscated about $5 billion worth of American weapons because the Iraqi military at the site of the Islamic State runs and leaves the military, the weaponry. In addition to that, they have been able to manage the towns that they have occupied. They're able to provide electricity, keep the store shelves filled, run a judicial system, albeit on Sharia law. But they have shown administrative expertise. They're the most sophisticated Islamic organization ever as it relates to using internet technology and social media, doing what they do best, which is to show the ruthlessness of their beheadings and crucifixions and why it is fruitless to resist the goad, shall we say, of Islam, but also to recruit jihadists to become the pointed stick of Islam. There's nothing ever that has approached the Islamic State in the long history of Islamic aggression as it relates to their overall success and popularity, the way that they are armed and their administrative capabilities. And so what we're witnessing here really is the first battles of World War III, of the Magog War, of these all-Islamic assaults against Israel. So it is important that we pay attention. Now, up to just recently, Lebanon had been uninvolved. This weekend, they attacked a border town in Lebanon. And up to this point, the Kurds and their militias had prevailed against the Islamic State. That is no longer the case. The Kurds were just destroyed in the most recent battles. In addition, the Iraqi government made it their principal goal to maintain control over Iraq's largest dam, not only as a source of water, not only as a source of electricity, but primarily because that dam, if breached, would lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths, both in the short term through flooding and the long term through the lack of irrigation and source of water. Devastating. They lost control of the dam. They lost control of more oil fields. They lost control of more cities. And this time it was the Kurds that were defeated. Capture of the Mosul Dam after an offensive of barely 24 hours could give the Sunni militants the ability to flood major Iraqi cities, sharply raising the stakes in their bid to topple Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's Shiite government. That is not their goal. Their goal is not to topple the Maliki regime. Their goal is to build a base or an emirate for fundamentalist Islam from which to expand and then use that as the foundation to turn the whole world into a place where Islam is up against non-Muslims in a world war. Ultimately, trying to compel the entire world through force to either acquiesce to surrender to Islam or die. That's their goal. To think that their goal is to topple the Maliki Shiite government is to be wholly ignorant of who they are and what they represent. The Islamic State, which sees Iraq's majority Shiites as apostates who deserve to be killed, also seized the Zala oil field, adding four others already under their control and three towns. That's how they're financing themselves. They faced strong Kurdish resistance only at the start of their latest offensive when taking the town of Zumar. The Islamists then hoisted their black flags there. You know, it used to be that these black flags were always equated to the Al-Qaeda flag. But all you have to do is read the Islamic Hadith, and you'll find that Muhammad had three different colors of flags, and those flags were flown as symbols of his jihadist conquests, his terrorist assaults on the community within camel's ride of Mecca and Medina. They're Islamic flags with Islamic symbolism having nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. This is a ritual, according to this article, that usually precedes mass executions of captured opponents and then the imposition of an ideology even Al-Qaeda finds excessive. And that's not true. It's just not true. It's just such a corruption of the facts. It's the imposition of Sharia law. That's all they're imposing. Pure Sharia law. Sharia law is based entirely on the words and deeds of Muhammad, as they are found in the Hadith and to a lesser degree in the Quran. And since Muhammad was a rapist, a pedophile, incestuous, a mass murderer, a ruthless terrorist, a kidnapper, a slave trader, a set of laws based upon his repulsive life is dehumanizing. It is an ideology that is the most savage ever promoted by humankind. Now, Sharia law is absolutely not excessive for what little exists now of Al-Qaeda. They would be in lockstep with Sharia law. The only thing Zayman al-Zawahiri had against the Islamic State is that it was his opinion that they were too ruthless on fellow Muslims and therefore might dissuade some Muslims from being jihadist to further the Islamic desire to rid the world of Jews and then Christians. That was Osama bin Laden's issue, of course, with them was that they were in Iraq being identified somehow with Al-Qaeda when they had no identity with Al-Qaeda whatsoever, and he was disappointed by that. But Zawahiri's only issue was that their tactics as it relates to their battles, particularly in Syria when the Islamic State began to fight al-Nusra, which may have now ended with the Islamic State prevailing. Zawahiri didn't like that. But there has never been a disagreement between what little exists now of Al-Qaeda and Ayman Zawahiri and the imposition of the ideology. I mean, this Reuters journalist is an absolute moron. The imposition of Islamic ideology is why both organizations exist. And their interpretation of that ideology is identical because it is from the Quran. It's from the Hadith. It's a derivative of Muhammad. There is no difference in interpretation of Sharia. There is no difference in interpretation of Islam amongst these organizations. The thing they have in common is Islam, is Sharia, is the imposition of Sharia. They wouldn't differ one iota in that regard. Now, since thousands of Iraqi soldiers fled the Islamic State's offensive, Shiite militias and Kurdish fighters have been seen as the critical line of defense. Well, it's actually the last line of defense against the militants. And so for America to side against the Sunni militants that it equipped in Syria, but to side against them in Iraq is to have to use Hezbollah and the Kurdish Mujahideen to fight them. But America has been wholly opposed to an independent Kurdish state in Iraq. And any sane person is opposed to Hezbollah. So what side is the American position? And this now says that they have threatened to march on Baghdad. Yes, they said that they will march on Baghdad, but they're taking their time. If they had attacked Baghdad a month or so ago, when they were making these enormous gains of territory and consolidating their positions in Syria and Iraq, it is likely that they would have done themselves in. That's one of the reasons why it was so uncomfortable talking about the success of ISIS, which became the Islamic State, because if they were to have taken on Baghdad, as they were all spread out and having these enormous initial victories, you would have expected them to have overstretched their capability, as is typical among Islamic groups driven by ego and hubris, that they would have failed. But they didn't do that. That is why this group is so important for us to watch. Now, at this point, as of Sunday, as of yesterday, the battles have called into question whether or not the Kurdish Mujahideen are indeed effective, and whether or not Iraq can be salvaged. Because, you see, the only way that you can have a Shiite government over Iraq is to get at least one minority group to participate. It's always been the Kurds. And the reason it has been is, if you realize that the reason the Kurds know how to fight is that the Kurds, towards the end of the Iraq-Iran war, made a strategic blunder. And they decided that if they accepted Iranian weapons, even though they were Iraqis, and used the Iranian weapons along with Iranians to attack Iraq, that they could create a homeland for themselves that the Iranians would support. But the Iranians didn't support that. And that's why the Kurdish village was gassed. It was a terrible miscalculation. We'll return to this story in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So when you understand why the Kurds have been up to this point successful, which is that the Kurds have been militant for a long time because the Kurds accepted Iranian arms during the midst of the Iraq-Iran war, where the United States, by the way, was on the side of Iraq against the Iranians, which means the United States was on the side of Iraq against the Kurds, which were Iraqis that picked up arms against Iraq. Which also means that this basis of justifying the invasion of Iraq to depose Saddam Hussein because he was a mass murderer of innocent little boys and girls is nonsense, because the only reason the Kurdish communities were gassed is that with the Kurdish militants inside of Iraq as Iraqi citizens wielding Iranian weapons to kill Iraqis, the Iraq military was unable, in what had become a stalemate between Iraq and Iran, was unable to deflect the additional pressure of the internal assault against it. And so the only way to survive the Iranian Kurdish assault was to gas the Kurdish towns. And one in particular caused the death of, I think, 4,000 or 5,000 people. But if you want to blame that on someone, America supplied the weapons, and the Iranians negotiated with the Kurds to fight against their own country. Now, recognizing that, America has never been on the side of the Kurds. Now, I think that the Kurds deserve a homeland. It's the largest racial group. Some 20 to 30 million strong, that don't have a homeland of their own, don't have any political autonomy. They live in eastern Turkey where they're abused. They live in northern Iran where they're abused. And they live in northern Iraq where until recently they have been abused. But the American invasion of Iraq, while the America was wholly opposed to giving the Kurds any dominion, they have taken it upon themselves. Now, the problem here is America doesn't want to recognize a Kurdish nation. And America is in a horrible fix in that it has always been opposed to the Kurds. And now we have our instructions to the Iraqi government that America supplies all of the weapons that has been besmirching the Kurds for having left the government. They pulled all of their representatives out. And they said, you know, we don't want anything to do with the Iraqi government in Baghdad. We're going to do our own thing in the Northeast. And now, based upon having lost this battle, there is this tendency for the Iraqi government to say, all right, let's go and engage on behalf of the Kurds. But they can't do that because the Kurds have seceded from the Union. And America is confiscating their oil and not reimbursing them. So now what? Does the Islamic State gradually take over that area and protect its flank as it appears to be doing? And is the threat of retaliation, the blowing up of the dam that will kill hundreds of thousands of people? This was an enormously important battle that took place over this weekend. In a statement on its website, the Islamic State said its fighters had killed scores of Kurdish fighters. Hundreds fled, leaving vehicles and a large number of weapons and munitions, and the brothers control many areas. End quote. The Islamic State said, quote, the fighters arrived at the border triangle between Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Oh, boy. Now what? Now, Turkey has been a huge supplier of weapons and of Mujahideen into Syria to overthrow the Assad regime because it sees it as Shia. But the Turkish government has been acting like a terrorist agent against the Kurds. And so it likes to see Kurds pummeled. But now what? The Islamic State has systematically blown up Shiite mosques and shrines in the territory it seized, fueling levels of sectarian violence not seen since the 2006-2007 civil war. Every time there was another terrorist assault in Iraq, and hundreds of people killed, and they were losing several thousand people a month to terrorism in Iraq. And they would always say, well, it's not as bad as it was in 2006 and 2007. Well, now it is far worse than it was in 2006 and 2007. But the journalist is incapable of recognizing that line no longer works. It actually never did. We'll be back in a moment. This particular article continues with these words. The Islamic State has been trying to consolidate its gains, setting its sights on strategic towns near oil fields, as well as border crossings with Syria, so that it can move easily back and forth and transport supplies. Well, the truth is that they are consolidating their gains, and this ought to be a huge concern. Typically, Islamic terrorist organizations just lash out in rage. You know, get weapons, give them to a jihadist. If the jihadist dies in the cause, who cares? Just go on to the next battle. Not these boys. They're organized. Now, the assumption here is that the command and control of the Islamic State is comprised of those who were educated under the Saddam Hussein Iraq, that they have many Iraqi former military in their fold. But beyond that they have many Iraqi former politicians, government officials, professionals in their fold, that they have Iraqi businessmen in their fold. This is not a group of 20-something jihadists screaming Allahu Akbar, can't wait to be recruited and die for the cause, as we have seen amongst Islamic suicide bombers. This isn't Al-Qaeda. I will grab some Mujahideen and equip them to be murderers and go send them out on some hellish expression of Islam. Not that remotely. What this appears to be is that the Islamic State appears to be managed by the best of what was once the Iraq of Saddam Hussein. And that it is comprised of Iraqi military leaders, Iraqi government leaders, Iraqi business leaders. And therefore, what that means, and there's really no way of getting around that, because they're consolidating their power. They're able to operate very sophisticated weapon systems. They're able to perpetrate highly coordinated attacks, almost always attacking a community from at least 3 points in externally as well as 1 point internally simultaneously. They lose very few soldiers and usually confiscate not only the remnants of their opponents' troops that they used as bargaining chips, but all of their weapons. And they control a huge swath of both of those two countries and have obliterated the border between them. They have been highly strategic. Now, what that means is that the Islamic State is not and never has been an Al-Qaeda affiliate. Al-Qaeda affiliates do not operate this way. It means that they are an outgrowth of Saddam Hussein. But not in the sense that Saddam Hussein was a secularist, in the sense of the same people that once were part of the Saddam Hussein's Iraq's military and government and business community, but now under the leadership of a fundamentalist Muslim as opposed to a secularist. That being the case, the world's in for a extraordinarily painful lesson. That the consequence not only of breaking Iraq, which is what America did, but of arming the Iraqis, which is what America did. The Islamic State is not your typical terrorist organization. And they are operating uniquely in a way that is vastly more sophisticated in every possible way. They are consolidating gains. They are continuing to set their sights on strategic towns near border crossings so that they can move more freely back and forth. And we should expect them to continue to soften the border between this Islamic State and Lebanon, between the Islamic State and Jordan, between the Islamic State and Turkey, between the Islamic State and Saudi Arabia. That is what we should expect. Now, there is no chance in the world that the Islamic State is going to take on Iran. And that's why there will be a carve-out of Shiite areas in Iraq that it's not going to touch, that will be annexed into Iran. Iran is a much, much larger country than Iraq. Iran is a vastly better armed nation than Iraq. The Islamic State would essentially destroy itself if it were to attempt to take over Iran. And so we should expect that they may choose to take over Sunni communities in Baghdad, carving out the Shiite communities. And we may expect them to allow Shia Muslims to continue to live but annexed into Iran in the southeastern region of that country. But they're going to use this as a base, ultimately, to integrate parts of Lebanon and much of Jordan, as well as perhaps some territory in Saudi Arabia, into their base. This article reads that the Kurds have long dreamed of their own independent state, an aspiration that has angered Malaki, who has frequently clashed with the non-Arabs over budgets, land, and oil. You see, in Iraq, you have a lot of Persian Shiites because of the border with Iran. But the Sunnis would mostly consider themselves Arabs. The Kurds do not. The Kurds draw their heritage from the Caucasus region, and therefore ethnically are not Arabs, nor are they Turks. After the Islamic State arrived, Kurdish forces seized two oil fields in northern Iraq and took over operations from a state-run oil company, complicating the task of trying to hold the country together. No, it was impossible at that point. Now you had three countries. There's Baghdad as the capital of Shiite Iranian Iraq. There's the Islamic State as most of Iraq and most of Syria. And then there was the Kurdish region, a little enclave in the extreme northeast of the country. Now, the only hope to mitigate the conflict was to recognize that the country had been divided into three and let it remain divided into three, and to have America withdraw its influence and its weapons, to have Iran do the same, and just to say, all right, you all got what you want. You have Sunnistan, Shiistan, and Kurdistan. Stop the war. That, unfortunately, is going to happen because you've got nations like the United States demanding the impossible, which is integration. In July, the Kurdish political bloc ended participation in Iraq's national government, something I shared with you previously. The accusation that Kurds were allowing terrorists to stay in Arbil, the capital of their semi-autonomous region, was known as Kurdistan, was levied at them by Malaki's government, the Shia. In another move certain to infuriate the Baghdad government, the Kurdish region is pressing Washington for sophisticated weapons. It says that the Kurdish fighters need to push back the Sunni Islamist militants. And the Kurdish and U.S. officials are talking because America loves supplying weapons. But Malaki needs the Kurds, who gained experience fighting Saddam Hussein's forces, to help defend his country from the Islamic State, whose leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, that's not his name. His name now is gone back to his birth name. He only uses his birth name, which is Ibrahim. And now it's Caliph Ibrahim, has a 10 million U.S. bounty on his head. This can't be fixed. There will never again be even the pretense of a united Iraq, nor should there be. Islamic State ambitions have alarmed other Arab nations who fear their success, which has been overwhelming, would embolden militants in their countries. Yeah, if I were Jordan right now, I'd be counting my days. In fact, if I were the king of Jordan, Abdullah, right now, I'd be transferring my wealth into other countries and fleeing because it's just a matter of time. Islamic State fighters were among militants who clashed with the Lebanese forces overnight and around Lebanon's border town of Arsal. At least 10 Lebanese soldiers and an unknown number of militants and civilians died in the fighting. Without a peep, of course, from the United Nations. On Friday, Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah urged regional leaders and religious scholars to prevent Islam from being hijacked by militants. Yeah, that's really funny. And the only reason there is a Saudi Arabia is because Saud was a warlord. He was a militant. He formed an alliance with Wahhab, who was an Islamic scholar. And so fundamentalist Islamic scholars under Wahhab joined with Saud at the warlord to create a unified blend of militancy and religion. And collectively, they went after the Turks and they rid Mecca of Turkish influence and ultimately were rewarded by Britain for having fought the Turks on behalf of the British. It's amazing that King Abdullah made two speeches here over this weekend. One was saying that the world needs to look at the Gaza uprising as a call to turn against Israel, that Israel is the common foe, and that Muslims need to unite relative to that common foe. In addition to that, King Abdullah urged the religious leaders, when they talk about religious scholars, to prevent Islam from being hijacked by militants. It was absolute pure hypocrisy. Because if it wasn't for the integration of Islam and militancy, Saudi Arabia wouldn't exist. It exists expressly because Saab and Wahhab got together in a union of Islam and militancy. But beyond that, you can't have a religious scholar disunite Islam from militancy. It's impossible. Islam was born with the sword. Islam is nothing more than the words and deeds of Muhammad. Muhammad was a militant. Muhammad was a worse kind of militant in the sense that he wasn't a general over an army that was trying to protect his people. It wasn't even a general over an army fighting generals of other communities for booty and conquest. He was the religious head of terrorists, of militants, who used weapons to attack defenseless civilian communities, whereby his militants raped the women, sold the children into slavery, and killed the men. And so you can't have Sharia law. You can't have Islam. You can't have the Quran. You can't have Allah. You can't have Muhammad. Nothing of Islam survives a dissection between Islam and militancy. Once Muhammad fled Mecca in shame, every verse that was revealed in Medina, yesteryear's Yathrib, is a call to arms. It's all a call for Muslims to fight jihad in Allah's cause. I mean, the eighth surah was to enshrine the merits of jihad, what's called the spoils of war, where booty is rendered lawful to Muslims, and glorifies Islamic killing, and tells Muslims they must fight and kill non-Muslims until there are no more non-Muslims, and everybody on the planet submits to Allah and Muhammad and Islam. And so to remove militancy from Islam is to remove Muhammad, the Sharia law, which is based on Muhammad's life, the Quran, which Muhammad himself uttered, which is filled with calls for Muslims to be militants. In fact, the Quran in the ninth surah says that a Muslim ceases to be a jihadist if they don't support jihad. If they're not militant, kill them. So you can't have the Quran, you can't have Muhammad, you can't have Sharia law You can't have Islam the moment you separate militancy from the religion. Now, in the darkness of Sunday morning, this article is one that is related. It says that Sunni fighters swept in to take one of the towns, Sinjar, and to set about their method of conquest, which is familiar at this point. Simple, bold-faced brutality. They destroyed a Shiite shrine, executed resistors, overran local security forces, and hoisted the black flag of the Islamic State. And this one says in Syria and Iraq or ISIS, but there is no Islamic State in Iraq or Syria anymore. They're simply the Islamic State above all of the government buildings. Hours later, the militants demanded that the city's residents swear allegiance to the Islamic State or be killed. The group's social media campaign is underway, with photos posted online showing the Mujahideen patrolling the city streets, gun raised in the air. The United Nations representatives in Baghdad, Maldanov, issued a statement on Sunday afternoon citing reports that as many as 200,000 civilians, mostly from the minority Yazidi community, had fled the new fighting. A humanitarian tragedy is unfolding in Sinjar, the UN spokesperson said. And yet, what have you been up to, Mr. UN? Running schools in Gaza that indoctrinate Muslim boys and girls to want to hate and destroy Israel. And now you have a mess in Iraq with absolutely no control and no influence. We'll be back.